Several years ago, we spent a lot of time on Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and you don't have to take any more calls now. That is, if we're live. This is a rerun. You take the calls. Whatever you think we are tonight. We spent a lot of time on a book by these same two authors. Give me camera one. The Dead Sea Scrolls Deception. The authors Michael Bajan and Richard Lee. The other book was Holy Blood, Holy Grail. They're good historic researchers. When they interpret the Bible, they get in over their head a bit. And I have a grown-up audience that can read and sort, so if you want to buy the book, go ahead. The thesis of the book, and they're not the only ones, is that the particular portion of the Dead Sea Scrolls that came under the control of what used to be the Rockefeller Museum had an a priori fixed frame of reference under the control of the Catholic Church through the modern continuation under a new name, the Inquisition, or the Holy Office, through the École Biblique founded in Jerusalem. They control the international team of scholars that were first an international board of a private foundation, subsequently given to the Jordanian government and nationalized, and then subsequent to the Six-Day War, taken over by Israel. In spite of the fears and the anti-Semite frame of reference of DeVoe, the head of the school, and thus the commission that controlled the scrolls, they feared that the Israeli government Department of Antiquities would take the scrolls that had been under the exclusive possession of this small group, the so-called international team, would take it into Israel, join it to those that were in the famous monument to the book and to the scrolls that everyone visits that goes to Israel, Jerusalem. Israel did not do that. They still allowed the independent international team, though now under the control of Israel, because since the museum had been nationalized by the Jordanian government, thus owned by the state, it became the property of the Israeli government. But they still allowed the independents, with other fish to fry and not wanting to create an international furor, they still allowed the international team to control the scrolls and their disposition. Some scrolls had already become a property of the Department of Antiquity of Israel, having been bought in New York City after a circuitous route from the Jacobite Church and its metropolitan in Jerusalem to an ad in the Wall Street Journal and a sale that took place in the Waldorf Astoria. But that was the minor portion of the scrolls. The majority scrolls were under the possession of this international team, the fruit continued of the original team of the Rockefeller Museum. And because this team was under the control, I repeat, of scholars dominated by the École Biblique, traced to a commission appointed by the Pope to protect the faith, sharing facilities and leadership with the successor to the Holy Office, the Inquisition, and with the absolute mandate to protect and preserve the traditions of the Church. It is the thesis of this book, and I think the right one. And increasingly, the judgment of Scholars International that brought the Huntington Act in recent news, that released the copies that have been obtained by one of the Bechtel women. They released the copies to the world and created a furor with threatened suits. Now it's died down, and in the years ahead, the scrolls are going to be the property of the whole academic world, which is what it should be. But in the suppression over these many years since 1947, there has been a deliberate attempt to avoid the possibility that anything in the Dead Sea Scrolls would disturb or contradict the historic Catholic tradition regarding the first century church, and to avoid anything that would counter-affect the historic traditional viewpoint of Judaism of that first century. Thus, the attempt has been made, succeeded, and scholarship almost en masse accepted, because they had no access, that the Qumran community was formed and these scrolls produced and or hidden away about 165 B.C., about the time Daniel was supposed to have been written. By doing this, we have a small band outside the mainstream of Judaism, predating Christianity. Thus, neither can historic traditional Judaism be affected, nor can Christianity be affected, since the community existed prior to Christianity. The basis for this has been a very weak foundation for dating. One is the science of studying script. For example, if you look at letters written in 17th century America, the writing style was different than letters written today. It won't be long before handwriting disappears. No, we'll have computer printouts. But that so-called science, analyzing styles of writing and dating them in a strata of development, is very imprecise in the first place. And in the second place, when applied to classic documents, anyone knows that the copyists have a tendency, indeed a dedication, to perpetuate the script at the time of the classic document's production, which is why you'll see many Bibles on display to continue to carry forward those that are manuscript form that you've seen in our collection, to carry forward the style of writing and not only copy the contents, but copy and perpetuate the style. Now, the commercial documents that are found at Qumran or the Dead Sea Scrolls might tend to reflect the writing style of the age of production. But the most important documents, which are the religious texts, classic documents, there is not any pattern that can be counted on of change of style. Because the more probable happening is that in those biblical and classical documents, they will perpetuate the style as well as the content. So it's a very inexact, imprecise method of dating. And it is only useful to correlate with and support other sounder, more objective bases. And those that have skills in doing that are so limited, they themselves tend to dominate with subjective viewpoints. The other is archaeological, primarily coins in the international team. They have found coins, and based upon coins, they date it because of the number of Jewish coins diminishing at one time and the number of Roman coins increasing. This book devastatingly blows that theory apart. In the first place, the first dating was based upon a coin that was supposed to be linked to the 10th Legion that after they published in the international team published in journals across the world and dated based on that coin, it was found they were totally in error. Not only an error in the coin, but the 10th Legion was nowhere near where they said it should be. So it was historically wrong and numismatically wrong. Yet they stuck to it, and only after much pressure and many years later, in another piece of literature, in a very small footnote, did they sort of cavalierly say, well, the coin was not what we thought it was. And those two imprecise bases for dating have been the only basis, as they have continued to refuse access from scholars that might raise some questions about the traditional Jewish view and the traditional Christian view. What has come out as the cracks in the wall have been forced open is that more likely the Qumran community existed around the time of Christ, after the time of Christ, and was connected to the group that became famous for the suicides and the stand they took against the Romans at Masada, which brings us up almost to the destruction of Jerusalem. So instead of being 2 centuries or a century and a half before Christ, it was concurrent with Christ. Furthermore, the international team would have us believe that these are quiet, Essene-type, splinter group Jews, an isolated cult living off in some caves by the Dead Sea, not part of mainstream Judaism, very passive, very peaceful, when in fact the cracks in the wall being pulled open, it is becoming very clear in various documents included in the Dead Sea Scrolls that they were very militant, they were closer to the Zealots, they hated the Herodians. Herod was an Edomian. He was a descendant of Esau. He was placed on the Jewish state throne as a puppet of Rome. And the high priest, Ananias, at the time of the death of James in the New Testament, which is subsequent to Christ, that high priest was a compromiser, had brought in the Sadducees, and instead of being remote, cultic, pacifist, celibate, we are now finding there were graves for families. They weren't celibate. They did marry. They were revolutionaries, and they were fundamentalist fanatics. The evidence is leaping out that they viewed the high priest as a compromiser with the Herodians and a compromiser with the Romans, and that their conflict was between the wicked priest, for whom they held nothing but contempt and hatred, and their goal within Judaism was to restore zeal for the law and a priest of the line of Aaron, uncontaminated with Hellenistic compromise and Roman compromise and Herodian compromise, and that they were fundamentalists par excellence for the law, and that their other enemy that crops out of their literature was the great liar, as they dubbed him. The great liar who had once persecuted them with authority from the wicked priest, who then became a convert to their group, and who then, after becoming a convert, turned on them, took converts out of their group, and in essence started a new religion, and he's dubbed the great liar, the apostate, who was once a member and then turned on them and departed from the way of the law. And in between these two, they stood trying to preserve historic fundamentalist Judaism and a return to the law with a substitute priest who was called the teacher of righteousness, who ultimately would die a martyr's death, but who was standing against the false priest, the wicked priest, who compromised with the Herodians and the Romans. They had their priest, whose zeal for the law qualified him, and they stood with their substitute priest, the teacher of righteousness, between this wicked priest who compromised the historic Judaic faith and the great liar who had been a part of them, but then turned on the law himself and took masses of converts and preached another righteousness. Thus, the thesis of this book and many others is that the Qumran community was a hardline fundamentalist Judaic group who believed in a Messiah and who sought to preserve the ancient zeal for the law, and they were around producing, no doubt, John the Baptist. They were there providing in Simon the Zealot, even a member of Christ's own disciple group, and that Paul was a member of the group. And he was a member of the group around Ananias the wicked priest. And it was with papers from Ananias, who had the authority of Herod, that made him head to Damascus to persecute this very group. He is converted, becomes a member of the group, goes to Damascus, is healed, remains with the group and is taught, is a convert to the group, and then turns on them and is the great liar. Now, that's the thesis of this book. Whether Paul is what they say he is or not, I am convinced they're on the track with James. I confess a possible bias. But the bias is not bias and very objective when I say James, if he was not a part of this group, had one almost identical. So I read the chapter to you now, in which they, with that broad background and broad strokes, relate James the righteous, the James of the New Testament, to the Qumran teacher of righteousness. You want me to? If James played so important a role in the events of the time, it's too hot in here, Reggie. If James played so important a role in the events of the time, why do we know so little about him? Why has he been relegated to the status of a shadowy figure in the background? Now, this book, more than anything else, was spawned by Eisenman's book, and he's written several. But you may want to look up Eisenman, R.H. is his initials, R.H. Eisenman, Maccabees, Zadokites, Christians, and Qumran, published in 1983. Second book, James the Just in the Habakkuk Peshur, published in 1986. Those two are good enough. And this book draws upon Eisenman quite a bit. Those questions can be answered simply enough. Eisenman stresses that James, whether he was literally Jesus' brother or not, had known Jesus personally. In his teachings, he was certainly closer to, quote, the source than Paul ever was. That I'm not willing to agree with. And as I've said, when they analyze Scripture, they tend to suffer because they don't have the gestalt of the whole picture. Paul had some close association with Peter, as James did. And there is no evidence that James ever accepted Jesus until after the resurrection for his claims. Indeed, there is evidence that the family, if James was a member of the family, his brothers and his mother, sought to lay hands on him and protested the claims that he made. And I've commented in teaching that James pastored for 19 years in Jerusalem, and the Pharisees still thought that he would be a spokesperson to deny that Jesus was Messiah. So he didn't have a very vociferous testimony of Jesus the Christ. And as Luther says, not one word of gospel in his epistle. He teaches law. But to say he's closer to the source than Paul ever was is simply wrong. Paul had association with Mark. Paul had association with Peter. Paul had association with other brethren. If you have faith in the revelation of God's Word, he received direct teaching from Christ. But be that as it may, James' objectives and preoccupations were often at variance with Paul's, were sometimes indeed diametrically opposed. Indeed they were. And I wish the whole evangelical church would swallow that and accept it. For Paul, then, James would have been a constant irritant. With the triumph of Pauline Christianity, therefore, James' significance, if it couldn't be obliterated completely, had at the very least to be diminished, absolutely. Unlike a number of personalities in the New Testament, James does seem to have been a historical personage, and moreover, one who played a more prominent role in the affairs of his time than is generally recognized. There is, in fact, a reasonably copious body of literature pertaining to James, even though most of it lies outside the canonical compilation of the New Testament. In the New Testament itself, James is mentioned in the Gospels as one of Jesus' brothers, though the context is generally vague, and that's true. In Acts, he assumes rather more prominence, though it is not until the second part of Acts that he emerges in any kind of perspective. Then with Paul's letter to the Galatians, he is clearly identified as the leader of the early church who resides in Jerusalem and is attended by a council of elders. Apart from those that impinge on Paul, however, one learns very little of his activities, even less about his personality and biography. Neither is the letter of James in the New Testament of much value in this respect. Yeah, it is. He hates the rich, revels in the poor, misquotes the two texts he used to argue with Paul, both the one about Abraham offering Isaac and the reason why Rahab is saved, And in essence, takes the unequivocal position that you're saved by works and not by faith. Such is James' role in Scripture proper. But if one looks further afield, a portrait of James does begin to emerge. This is the research which Eisenman has been pursuing over the last few years. One source of information he has emphasized is an anonymous text of the early church, the so-called, quote, Recognitions of Clement, end quote, which surfaced very early in the 3rd century. According to this document, James is preaching in the temple when an unnamed enemy, accompanied by an entourage of followers, bursts in. The enemy, quote, taunts James' listeners. The enemy, accompanied by an entourage of followers, bursts in. This, quote, enemy taunts James' listeners and drowns out his words with noise, then proceeds to inflame the crowd with revilings and abuse, and like a madman to excite everyone to murder, saying, quote, what do ye? Why do ye hesitate, O sluggish and inert? Why do we not lay hands upon them and pull all these fellows to pieces? The enemy does not confine himself to verbal assault. Seizing a brand of wood. You want me to continue? You're on telephone. The enemy does not confine himself to verbal assault. I'm going to pick up right where I left off, the chapter on James the Righteous in this book, Dead Sea Scrolls Deception, by Badgett and Lee. Seizing a brand of wood, he begins to flail about with it at the assembled worshipers, and his entourage follows suit. A full-scale riot ensues. Quoting from the Recognitions of Clement, much blood is shed. There is a confused flight. End your phone calls, please. There is a confused flight in the midst of which that enemy attacked James and threw him headlong from the top of the steps, and supposing him to be dead, he cared not to inflict further violence upon him. James, however, is not dead. According to the Recognitions, his supporters carry him back to his house in Jerusalem. The next morning before dawn, the injured man and his supporters flee the city, making their way to Jericho, where they remain for some time, presumably while James convalesces. Now, there are two major weaknesses in this whole argument here when you read the book. There is evidence that the Qumran community, once called its place of central activity Damascus. This book, Eisenman and those that are criticizing the international team, argue that the Qumran community itself was one time calling itself Damascus or disguising itself as Damascus in its own literature. Thus, on that premise, they have Paul on the road to Damascus, traveling from Jerusalem down toward Jericho to the Qumran community under the name of Damascus, rather than to Damascus in Syria. That is totally unnecessary to their own thesis. In the volatile time immediately prior to and immediately after Christ, with the Roman foot trampling the Jewish state that had been formed in the Maccabean rebellion and a rebellion against the Seleucid king Antiochus Epiphanes, and the puppet ruler Herod, there is every reason to believe that the Qumran community could have been mobile. They could have literally left the Jewish state area and set up shop, much like the PLO does today, in Damascus. I think it's overreaching to try to apply the term Damascus to Qumran because you don't want to accept the fact that Paul was journeying to Damascus, and even after his blinding incident on the road to Damascus, he goes to a street called Straight in Damascus, where he's prayed for and his blind sight is restored. The second place they stretch is because the similarities to what happened to James in the Recognitions of Clement, as reported therein, the 3rd century document, is so similar to what happened to Stephen. They seek to make the account in the book of Acts of the stoning of Stephen somehow not true, but an attempt to describe what happened to James under the guise of Stephen. Such overstretching makes their very sound arguments about the Qumran community being not a cloistered cult, not out of the mainstream any more than fundamentalists are out of the mainstream of Christianity in America, any more than the fundamentalists in the Islamic communities are out of the mainstream of the Muslims, or any more than the fundamentalist bent that now controls the Pope and at least the Vatican in the Catholic stream are out of the mainstream. The Qumran community was not a cult, not a splinter group. Indeed, it was a mainstream fundamentalist effort that included the Nazarenes, the Zealots, the Sicarii, and ultimately, because some of the same documents found at Qumran, copies of the same documents are found at Masada, and probably the group at Masada was of the same. They were a hold-the-fort, mainstream, restore zeal for the law, broad-based movement. And there's no reason to believe they couldn't base temporarily their leadership in Damascus, for whatever reason, back and forth from Qumran to Damascus, and when the heat died down or the death of Herod occurs, they come back to Qumran. When the Romans come to crush them, they bury and hide away the documents. You don't have to manufacture an artificial Damascus. Neither do you have to question the stoning of Stephen in the New Testament, because it's very apparent in Acts that James outlived Stephen by a long time. Those attempts to try to connect dots that don't exist in the picture make these guys sound as ridiculous as the people they're criticizing. So you got to sort the truth from both sides. The truth seems to be the Recognitions of Clement describe James as a revolutionary type leader that suffers persecution but still has access to the temple. The Recognition of Clement concludes, "Then after 3 days, one of the brethren came to us from Gamaliel, bringing us secret tidings that the enemy had received a commission from Caiaphas, the chief priest, that he should arrest all who believe in Jesus and should go to Damascus with his letters." Now, that's a direct quote from the Recognitions of Clement. And the enemy, understand that this is a group within Christianity and within Judaism. Now, I'm telling you, that's exactly what James was. James never, ever thought that the Christian church would leave Judaism. To James, Christianity was the culmination of Judaism. To James, Christ was the Messiah, but he came not to destroy the law, but to fulfill it, not just to fulfill it himself, but to guarantee the fulfillment by all of his disciples. And to James, Christ and the Holy Spirit was to empower the fulfilling of the law as the criteria of salvation. And to James, Christianity was the essence of Judaism fulfilled. Thus, he was both Jew and Christian. Thus, he viewed his community and his church as the true Judaism and the only Christianity. And that would then have him fit into this group of the early Christians and the Qumran zealots who would view Paul at this time as their enemy. The enemy had received a commission from Caiaphas, the chief priest, that he should arrest all who believed in Jesus and should go to Damascus with his letters. End of quote. The surviving editions of Josephus' Antiquities of the Jews contain only one reference to James, which may or may not be later interpolation. The Chronicle reports that the Sanhedrin, the religious high court, called before them James, the brother of Jesus, who was called Christ. James and certain of his companions are found guilty and accordingly stoned to death. Whether this account is accurate, doctored, or wholly invented in Josephus, the most important aspects of it is the date to which it refers. Josephus indicates that the events he has described occurred during an interval between Roman procurators in Judea. The incumbent procurator had just died. His successor, Lucius Albinus, was still en route to Palestine from Rome. During the in-between, the interregnum, effective power in Jerusalem was wielded by the high priest, an unpopular man named Ananus. This allows the account of James' death to be dated at around AD 62, only 4 years before the outbreak of the revolt in AD 66. Here, then, is at least some chronological evidence that James' death may have had something to do with the war that ravaged the Holy Land between AD 66 and 73. For further information, one must turn to later church historians. Perhaps the major source is Eusebius, 4th century bishop of Caesarea, the Roman capital of Judea on the coast, and author of one of the most important early church histories. Indeed, he's called the father of church history, I'd say. In accordance with the conventions of the time, Eusebius quotes at length from earlier writers, many of whose works have not survived. In speaking of James, Eusebius quotes Clement, Bishop of Alexandria, AD 150 to 215. Clement refers to James as, quote, the righteous, or as it is often translated, quote, the just, the tzaddik in Hebrew. This, of course, is the by now familiar Qumranic usage, which derives or whence derives the teacher of righteousness, the leader of the Qumran community. According to Clement, Eusebius reports, James was thrown from a parapet of the temple, then beaten to death with a club. Later in his chronicle, Eusebius quotes extensively from a second century church historian, Hegesippus. All of Hegesippus' works were reputedly extant or around to be seen as late as the 16th or 17th century. Everything since that time has disappeared, though copies may well exist in the Vatican as well as in the library of one or another monastery. At present, however, almost everything we have by Hegesippus is contained in the excerpts from his work cited by Eusebius. Quoting Hegesippus, Eusebius states that James the righteous was holy from his birth. Quote, he drank no wine, ate no animal food, no razor came near his head, he did not smear himself with oil, and took no baths. He alone was permitted to enter the holy place, the holy of holies in the temple. And let me tell you, there ain't no little minor cult that could allow anybody to enter the holy place. Only the high priest entered the holy place. Took no baths. He alone was permitted to enter the holy place, the holy of holies in the temple. For his garments were not of wool, but of linen, priestly robes. He used to enter the sanctuary alone. and was often found on his knees beseeching forgiveness for the people, so that his knees grew hard like a camel's. Because of his unsurpassable righteousness, he was called the righteous and bulwark of the people. At this point, it is worth interrupting the text to note certain intriguing details. James is said to wear linen or priestly robes. This was the prerogative of those who served in the temple and belonged to one of the priestly families, traditionally the Sadducean aristocracy, who during the first century came to an accommodation with Rome and the Herodian dynasty of Roman puppets. Again, as Eisenman points out, Epiphanius, another church historian, speaks of James wearing the mitre of the high priest. Then, too, only the high priest was allowed to enter the Holy of Holies, the inner sanctum and most sacred spot in the temple. What, then, can James be doing there? And without eliciting any explanation or expression of surprise from church historians, who seem to find nothing untoward or irregular in his activities, did he, perhaps by virtue of his birth, have some legitimate right to wear priestly apparel and enter the Holy of Holies? Or might he have been acting in the capacity of a kind of opposition high priest, a rebel who, defying the established priesthood's accommodation with Rome, had taken upon himself the role they had betrayed? Certainly the established priesthood had no affection for James. According to Hegesippus, the scribes and Pharisees decided to do away with him so that the people will be frightened and not believe him. They proclaim that, quote, even the righteous one has gone astray, and invoke a quote from the Old Testament, in this case from Prophet Isaiah, 3rd chapter, 10th verse, to justify their actions. They note that Isaiah had prophesied the death of the righteous one. In murdering James, therefore, they will simply be bringing Isaiah's prophecy to fulfillment. But also in using this quote from Isaiah, they're following a technique employed in both the Dead Sea Scrolls and the New Testament. Eisenman points out that just as this quote is used in order to describe the death of James, so the Qumran community employs similar righteousness passages from the New Testament in order to describe the death of their teacher of righteousness. Eusebius goes on to describe the death of James in the following manner. Quote, so they went up and threw down the righteous one. They said to each other, let us stone James the righteous, and began to stone him, and in spite of his fall, he was still alive. While they pelted him with stones, a member of a particular priestly family called out, stop, what are you doing? Then one of them, a fuller, took the club which he used to beat clothes and brought it down on the head of the righteous one. Such was his martyrdom. Still quoting from Eusebius. Immediately after this, Vespasian, the Roman general, began to besiege them. Vespasian, who became emperor in AD 69, commanded the Roman army that invaded Judea to put down the revolt of AD 66, ultimately resulting in the total destruction of Jerusalem. Here again, then, is a chronological connection between James' death and the revolt. But Eusebius goes further. The connection for him is more than just chronological. The entire siege of Jerusalem, this father of church history says, meaning presumably the whole of the revolt in Judea, was a direct consequence of James' death, for no other reason than the wicked crime of which he had been victim. To support this startling contention, Eusebius invokes Josephus. The passage of Josephus that Eusebius quotes can no longer be found in any existing version of Josephus. Yet was unquestionably what Josephus wrote, because Origen, one of the earliest and most prolific of the church fathers, quotes, independent of Eusebius, precisely the same passage. And that passage, referring to the revolt of AD 66 and the Roman invasion that followed, Josephus states that, quote, these things happened, the revolt, that is, and the Roman invasion. These things happened to the Jews in requital for James the righteous, who was a brother of Jesus known as Christ, for though he was the most righteous of men, the Jews put him to death. From these fragments pertaining to James, a scenario begins to take form. James, the acknowledged leader of the early church in Jerusalem, represents a faction of Jews who, like the Qumran community, are zealous for the law. This faction is understandably hostile toward the Sadducee priesthood and the high priest, Ananus, appointed by Herod, who have betrayed their nation and their religion by concluding an accord with the Roman administration and its Herodian puppet kings. So intense is this hostility that James arrogates to himself the priestly functions which Ananus had compromised. Ananus' supporters respond by contriving James' death. Almost immediately thereafter, the whole of Judea rises in revolt, and Ananus is himself one of the first casualties, assassinated as a pro-Roman collaborator. As the rebellion gains momentum, Rome is forced to react, and does so by dispatching an expeditionary force under Vespasian. The result is the war which witnesses the sack of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple and does not end until the fall of Masada in A.D. 74. The thesis, simply stated, is that the early church in Jerusalem, led by James, was the spear point of a revolutionary, zealous for the law, fundamentalist rebellion against the compromisers of the Jews. They not only saw themselves as a new faith under Christ, but rather a fulfillment of the prophecies of the Messiah, protectors of the law, pure and true Judaism. And they, with James at their head and the church in Jerusalem, fought against the compromising Judaism that had crucified Christ. Those who had joined and collaborated with Rome and with Herod, and when James was assassinated, a revolt broke out, which resulted ultimately in the destruction of the Qumran community, actually culminating at Masada with the siege there and the fall of Jerusalem, and thus the Qumran community was not some far-out cult, but indeed was mainstream fundamentalist, zealot, fanatic Judaism that had accepted Christ as the Messiah. And Paul, representing the Herodian established priesthood with papers to destroy him, converted and then received his revelation from God of the just shall live by faith. And he represents to James and the Qumran community, by this thesis, the great liar who turned against him. Now, whether I'm willing to go that far in the connections with Paul, I think we are going to find the Dead Sea Scrolls will reveal that the early Christian church at Jerusalem was very much peopled with members of the Qumran community, and we're going to find that one of their most vital documents is a commentary on Habakkuk. And that commentary on Habakkuk is almost like James's epistle. It's an attempt to prove that those that are saved by faith are only those that keep the law of Judah. And if you'll remember that the Apostle Paul, who takes that phrase, the just shall live by faith, and makes it the centerpiece of Rome, his letter to the Romans, his letter to the Hebrews, and his letter to the Galatians. And when you recall that threefold use of the phrase in the New Testament, with different emphasis, the just shall live by faith, the just shall live by faith, the just shall live by faith, a different emphasis in each of the three, Romans, Hebrews, and Galatians. But the verse is quoted from Habakkuk. And one of the most important documents among the Dead Sea Scrolls is the commentary on Habakkuk, where the teacher of righteousness takes that very same phrase, the just shall live by faith, and says that that can be applied only to those that are living in the law of Judah, and then their faith is acceptable to God. And it is so much a part of the exegesis, discussions, and commentaries of the Qumran community how coincidental that the Apostle Paul, who opposes James and puts a different interpretation, and the right one, on the just shall live by faith, and thus comes the cleavage between James and Paul that was never healed. James fell into disuse. Paul's epistles dominated, becoming two-thirds of the New Testament. And it wasn't until the Catholic Church canonized Scripture in the 5th century that James is put into the canon. He never should have been. James never, ever converted from Judaism. He just added Christ to it. And with Luther, I say, it's a right strawy little epistle he wrote, and there's not one word of gospel in it. But I am telling you that the Dead Sea Scrolls are going to shake up traditional Catholic Christian doctrine. They're going to shake mine up, but they're going to shake up traditional Christian Catholic doctrine as the academic world now has access and begins to blow apart the distorted and biased view of the international team that's kept the documents suppressed all these years. I'll have more to say if you're interested in it.